Welcome to Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Labor unions are losing members. Michigan has dropped from the fifth most unionized state to the seventh. On today's show, in the wake of the new right to work law, we look at what fewer union members means for our state, and we take a closer look at what climate change could mean for the future of the Midwest and how we're all going to have to adapt. But first, the trial of former Detroit Mayor Kwame Kilpatrick, his father Bernard Kilpatrick, and his longtime friend, contractor Bobby Ferguson, continues in federal court in downtown Detroit. The trio are accused of conspiring to get rich through the power of the mayor's office. And even as Kilpatrick arrived for court this morning, he was fresh off a weekend stay in jail for violating his parole in the 2008 conviction that got him kicked out of office. There are seemingly endless legal twists and turns that add up to the downfall of Kwame Kilpatrick and the possibility of many years in prison if found guilty of these federal corruption charges. Detroit Free Press journalist Jim Schaefer helped break the initial story in 2008, centering on text messages between the mayor and his then chief of staff and, as it turns out, mistress Christine Beatty. Those messages helped to send Kilpatrick to state prison. Schaefer's reporting on the Kilpatrick scandal earned him a Pulitzer Prize in 2009 and other journalism awards. Jim Schaefer takes a break from covering the latest Kilpatrick trial in downtown Detroit and joins us now. Hi, Jim.
Good day. How are you today?
Good. Glad to get out and get some fresh air.
Oh, this trial is really wearing me out.
This has been going on. Remind us again, when did it begin?
September 21st, I believe, was the day they had opening statements, and we've been going pretty much nonstop since then. They've had a couple breaks for people who had illnesses, but, you know, we're in the, I believe, fourth month and second week, so 4.5 months.
And it's still the prosecution presenting its case. You haven't even gotten to the defense.
That's right, but the prosecution is likely to wrap up Tuesday, tomorrow, and then we're going to take a day off, and the defense will start presenting its side on Wednesday, or Thursday it is.
So go in for us a little more deeply, Jim, exactly what this trial is about and what those 33 federal counts against Kwame Kilpatrick, what do they boil down to?
Well, I think you captured it pretty well just a few seconds ago when you said people trying to get rich off the mayor's office. The most serious charges against Kwame Kilpatrick and his father and his good friend Bobby Ferguson is basically a racketeering charge, otherwise known as RICO, which is a federal charge that was really created to go after the mafia back in the day.
Yes.
The government used it against many of the mafia families who couldn't have a murder or an extortion pinned on them. They came up with this charge because it is a way to, say, to attack the whole enterprise as opposed to pinning one particular crime on them. And it carries a pretty serious penalty. Up to 20 years in prison for each of these guys if they were to get convicted of it. There's also a number of other charges, as you mentioned, 33 against the former mayor himself. Some of them involve extortion, accepting bribes, and there's some tax charges on there, evasion, as well as not reporting his tax returns truthfully.
Jim, is there a connection between these federal charges and the state prison term that Kilpatrick served in the text message scandal?
That's a good question, but no. They're completely separate events. As you mentioned earlier, Kilpatrick went to jail the first time after the text message scandal broke. You know, Kim Worthy, the Wayne County prosecutor, charged him with, I think it was 8 felonies. The mayor fought long and hard and finally surrendered in October, you know, 10 months after we first broke that story, and agreed to go to jail. You know, he pleaded guilty to 2 felonies and no contest to a third and went to jail for 99 days. Then he got out, and his trouble really began because he was accused of violating his probation by hiding assets.
Because the probation really consisted of, you have to pay this money back to the people of Detroit.
Yeah. He was ordered to pay $1 million in restitution to the city for his crimes in a text message scandal. I said probation. It's really parole that he violated. It's a similar thing, but for guys that have already been convicted and gone in and done their sentence, it's parole.
And so that's what was behind his weekend trip to the jailhouse this past weekend.
Yes, for the second time, if you can believe that. He's been accused of hiding his assets. I think Fox 2 in Detroit first broke the story that right before Christmas, the former mayor accepted a $2,000 gift from a pastor in Chicago. Turns out, apparently, Kilpatrick had been sending out letters asking people to help contribute to their situation because they're destitute and they need all the help they can get because they're in the fight of their life. So he was accused of not telling the Department of Corrections about that gift and a couple of others. He is required as part of his parole to report all his income, and he's always had a problem with that, it seems. It's gotten him in trouble twice. The first time he went to prison for 14 months, much longer than the sentence in a text message scandal. And then this last time he just spent the weekend in jail.
He was actually seen on closed-circuit television cashing that check out at a store in Macomb County.
A Walmart out in Chesterfield Township.
Yeah. What I did hear was a soundbite as he was interviewed at the steps outside the federal courthouse where he, in essence, said, well, this is Detroit and I'm Kwame Kilpatrick. So after all of this, it boggles the mind, but is this not getting through to him?
Well, he is fond of painting himself as a victim in many of these circumstances. He has, you know, written an autobiography where he admits to some things. He, in his words, his crime was cheating on his wife. But as we all know, it was something much more in-depth than that. Mm-hmm. You know, he was accused of, in the text message scandal alone, using $8.4 million in city money to basically make his text messages go away and be hidden forever. Fortunately, that didn't happen. And he also, according to a civil lawsuit that was filed in 2007 that got him in trouble for perjury in the first place, ruined the careers of two or three police officers who dared to push an investigation that might have uncovered the mayor's affairs. So he is quite often in the mode where he asks for sympathy from some folks because he claims to be a victim.
What are your thoughts? Because you have such an incredible perspective, having been part of breaking this story with the text messages. What are your thoughts, Jim, about what the Kilpatrick years did to the people of Detroit?
That's a really good question, because I get varying responses from people. Some folks think the media in general is too hard on him, that the criminal justice system is too hard on him. And at the same time, there are other folks who think the exact opposite, that he is allowed to get away with things that people shouldn't be allowed to get away with. I think the city is still sort of reeling from the Kilpatrick years. For whatever reason. You know, it was in bad shape economically and in terms of crime and things before Kilpatrick took over. But he was a guy who came in 2001, fresh from the legislature, 31 years old. Everyone was in his camp. I mean, I think the Free Press endorsed him. Yeah. I think a lot of people thought that he could be much bigger than just the mayor of Detroit. And here was a guy who grew up, he said, to be the mayor of Detroit. So I think a lot of people put huge hopes in him. And just the dramatic fall is still stunning to many people in Detroit and around Michigan.
Jim, in this federal trial that you've been sitting through for the last 4 months, give us just a sampling of some of the testimony you've heard with respect to how attractive money was to these folks, it apparently.
Well, we heard Tony Suave, a very wealthy suburban businessman, talk about flying the mayor all over the country and to the Bahamas and places like that, to New York City for a Christmas shopping trip where Suave and the mayor and Christine Beattie went there one day and then came back the same day. We've also heard about stays in luxurious hotels, which which we wrote about for years at the Free Press before anything really came of it, where he would get spa treatments and things like that. We've written about, the trial has had testimony about the Kilpatrick Civic Fund, which is a nonprofit that he set up to ostensibly educate voters and to improve the lives of children in Detroit. And the federal government has presented testimony that it was basically a piggy bank for Kilpatrick, paying for things like tuition, summer camp, golf clubs, golf lessons, that kind of thing. But we've also heard perhaps even more dramatically about alleged kickbacks and payoffs that went to the mayor from people like Carl Cato, who was a contractor at Cobo Hall back during those days, and from a woman named Emma Bell, who was one of his Kilpatrick's fundraisers. She supposedly would give him a cut of whatever she would raise. So it's been pretty dramatic. The defense has done what they can to try to discredit these witnesses, claiming they're greedy and telling lies to benefit themselves in their own criminal cases with the prosecution in many instances. So it's going to be up to the jury to decide.
In fact, Kilpatrick's attorney James Thomas has said that the defense has been pretty much presenting its case as it cross-examines the witnesses.
Right.
So pretty much you're just what you're hearing is they're trying to discredit each of these many witnesses?
Yeah, the government has had a lot of cooperating witnesses in this case, meaning people who come in and admit they are guilty and then plead guilty to crimes in the case, but then as part of their cooperation with the government will come in and testify or at least cooperate during the investigation, helping the feds with information. And the defense has really gone after these folks to try to say they're just saying what the government wants them to say so they can get a lighter prison sentence when time comes for them to serve their own time. So we'll see.
Jim Schaefer, Detroit Free Press, covering the Kwame Kilpatrick trial. Thanks for talking with us today, Jim.
Oh, it's been a pleasure.
Still to come, more than 200 scientists have gotten together and written the National Climate Assessment, a report that details just how our climate is changing. We'll talk to one of the report's lead scientists about what climate change means for us here in the Midwest. That's in 20 minutes. You're listening to Michigan Radio, and this is Stateside. Labor unions are losing members. That is the stark truth of the latest figures out from the Bureau of Labor Statistics. On a national level, the percentage of American workers represented by a labor union dropped to its lowest level since the 1930s. Here in Michigan, 16.6% of workers belonged to a union last year. That's down from 17.5% in 2011. What that means is that Michigan fell from 5th to the 7th most unionized state. Let's discuss what these new federal numbers mean for the Wolverine state, especially in light of the right-to-work law that kicks in March 27th, when Michigan becomes the 24th state to adopt right-to-work. Joining me from the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan is Professor Roland Zula. Welcome.
Thank you.
And joining me in the studio from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, pleasure to welcome the Director of Labor Policy, Vincent Vernuccio. Good to have you with us.
Pleasure to be here.
Roland, I'd like to start with you, if I might. Were you surprised at these figures and at the decline in union membership in 2012, not just in Michigan, but across the country?
Well, no. There has been declining union membership across the country as a whole, really, since the 1980s. So this does continue a trend.
I agree with the professor. It does show a trend, but one thing that may be surprising for many people watching the decline or the change in membership is where the decline took place and actually where members increased. The non-right-to-work states drastically lost membership to the tune of almost 400,000 members. But what is a little surprising for people looking at the issue is that in right-to-work states, union membership actually grew. So there's a two-year trend of now actually right-to-work states being better for unions and making unions stronger and increasing the membership there than in the non-right-to-work states. So while Michigan lost over 40,000 union members last year, not being a right-to-work state, in the near future, that may actually start to change when unions become more accountable to their members and the economy picks up.
Do you see it from where you sit, Professor?
Well, I think that comment by Vincent was very deceiving. Right to work wasn't ever meant to help grow unions. It is true that there are some states in the South that saw a growth in unionization over the last year. Some surprising states like Tennessee, Mississippi, Kentucky, Georgia, North Carolina saw some increases, but all those states began with a very low percentage unionization to begin with, so the increase in the base is very, very small. We also saw increase in unionization from California, which is not a right-to-work state, and they saw a fairly good-sized jump over the last year. So to sort of suggest, as Vincent does, that right-to-work is helping grow unions in the South, it's just untrue.
I'm wondering, as we look at the 16.6% of workers in Michigan, so down from 17.5% at 2011, do you think that that shrinkage stemmed from layoffs or from workers choosing to leave the union? Vincent?
Well, first of all, workers did not have a choice before Michigan went right to work, and they still don't until the end of March when right to work takes effect. And even then, they have to wait for the contracts to change over. And I just want to counter one of the things that the professor talked about as far as an attack on workers. What right to work does is it simply gives workers the freedom to choose whether or not to financially support a union or not. Besides that, it does not affect a worker's ability to collectively bargain or a union's ability to collectively bargain at all. They can still bargain over wages, hours, working conditions, almost anything they can in non-right-to-work states, except the union can't bargain over the ability to get a worker fired for not paying them.
But what kind of, I want to get your thoughts on this, if I might, Professor.
Sure.
What might happen in workplaces where you have workers choosing, after we become right to work in March, where you have workers choosing not to pay dues, but meantime the coattail effect covers them so they still get the benefits that the union has negotiated. What do you think is going to be happening within the workers in that workplace?
What right to work is intended to do is to weaken unions, especially weaken them politically. There's really not very much evidence that right-to-work makes unions more responsive to union members. What it does do is it reduces the finances that unions have to engage in all kinds of other important activities. For example, growing their movement, organizing new members, requires funds for that, and right-to-work cuts back on that. More importantly still is the work that labor unions do in the political environment. Now, unions are one of the biggest advocates, for example, for laws that protect workplace safety or laws that raise the minimum wage. All of that activity comes with a cost, and what right to work was really meant to do is to undermine the ability for labor unions to engage in those kinds of political activities, which help benefit all workers.
If you're just joining us, this is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty, and we're looking at the situation for unions, labor unions losing members here in Michigan and from coast to coast. Speaking with research scientist Professor Roland Zullo from the Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy at the University of Michigan. And here in the studio from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, we have the Director of Labor Policy, Vincent Vernucchio. I'm curious, the Bureau of Labor Statistics finds that the biggest hit was in public sector unions. Roland, the obvious contributor would be the fact municipalities are certainly coping with budget shortfalls and laying off workers, but is there something deeper in that loss of public sector union workers?
Well, you know, as I already said, when you take away the right of workers to form a union and bargain, like what happened in Wisconsin, you're just going to have fewer unions in the public sector. So part of it is the political attack that's taking place here in the Midwest on workers' rights to join a union, join and form a union, and actually have a union that is effective once it does form. So, but you're correct. It's not what we're not seeing is that workers are rejecting unions. What we're seeing is a great many layoffs in sectors that are unionized. So the public sector generally has more unions than the private sector. We've seen some pretty heavy layoffs in the past couple of years in the public sector across the Midwest, and those are typically union jobs.
And let's talk autos. I'm wondering how much of this loss here in Michigan stems from the globalization of the auto industry and the auto supply base. They're going there as well. What percentage of those jobs do you think have a chance of returning to Michigan, Vincent?
Well, it's going to be one of the most telling things that if Toyota or one of the southern automakers that's, you know, foreign automakers mm-hmm. that has plants down south starts opening new plants in Indiana and Michigan and, you know, the new right-to-work states, that's going to show that, hey, the right-to-work law is working. I mean, you look at Indiana, and they just expanded their Caterpillar plant in Muncie. It was actually really funny that they opened it in Muncie because they moved most of the equipment. If they had any equipment to move, they took the plant that was building in London, Ontario, and they actually had to drive straight through Michigan to get to Indiana. So hopefully now those jobs that went over to Indiana will stop a little early and stop here in Michigan. And that's actually one of the main reasons why Governor Steiner and the legislature pushed for right to work now is in response to Indiana to make us more competitive, to attract more workers and job creators.
Oh, you know, Vincent, you're going off topic here. This wasn't really supposed to be about selling right to work, which I realize you're doing here. But, I mean, if you want to go back to the question, which is auto jobs, we've seen an increase in auto jobs in the past couple of years, in part because the UAW and the three major auto firms here in this state pulled together and came up with a plan to restructure and bring work back. And in fact, one of the reasons why the quality of the product coming out of Detroit now has improved is because they've actually done less outsourcing and they're bringing work back. So the job increase and the union membership increase in auto in Michigan has actually gone up. And this, of course, has nothing to do with right to work. It has everything to do with the fact that there was a labor union actively involved in working with auto industry executives to make this happen.
Well, I'd also like to point out that it was also the billions of dollars from the federal government given in a bailout that allowed the automakers to restructure.
Speaking of autos, I want to continue with that. Actually, today's Detroit News has a piece where they did talk with UAW President Bob King. And his quote, and here's because I want to see what your thoughts are and where we go. And a good place to start is what Bob King said, which is, we've got to re-energize and rebuild. I'm not blaming anybody. It's all of us. So all of us have got to accept responsibility. We're not accomplishing for our members, their families, or working people in general what we need to be. Roland, I'd like to start with you. What do they need to be accomplishing? What is it as Bob King starts to rally in following the right to work vote and what happened in 2012 and looking ahead? What needs to be happening in order to revitalize the unions, in your view?
Well, union growth and decline is closely linked to the political environment. And if the rules of society allow workers to form unions, then generally they do. In fact, one good piece of evidence of this is that, indeed, if you look over the years since 1980, there has been a decline in unionization, but that's primarily been in the private sector. We've seen, during that same period, we've seen a very steady growth until recent years when public workers have been attacked. We've seen a steady growth of unionization in the public sector. Well, why is that happening? It's happening because states over this period, actually slightly prior to this period, beginning of the 1960s, began passing laws that allowed workers to bargain collectively. Now, in the private sector, we have those laws as well. But what is threatening workers in the private sector is offshoring. And so, out of fear of losing their jobs, many workers in the private sector just simply won't entertain the idea of having a union.
But let me get you back to Bob King's statement, we're not accomplishing for our members, their families, or working people in general what we need to be doing. So what gap needs to be closed there?
Well, I don't exactly know full reference for that quote, but I think what Bob King might be talking about is going back to the vision of Walter Reuther. the legendary president of the UAW, his vision of the labor unions was not just to represent members, but to be engaged in the larger society about trying to lift up and pull up wage earners who are union, who are not union, but to really seek ways to improve society as a whole. And it seems like that quote speaks to that vision.
Well, I actually think Mr. King is right, and I agree with him. I may disagree with how they should change, but he is right that unions need to change. And first, let's talk about unions and politics, which the professor is talking about. Once again, going back to right to work, that's one of the strongest things to allow workers to opt out of their union's politics. Right now, if you're in a non-right to work state, there is a very long and burdensome process to opt out of your union's politics. You can't opt out of the full union's politics, only a portion of it, what's internal versus external communication, which is a little more complicated that I think we have time for here. Mm-hmm. But it's very hard to do when you only keep a small portion, you only get to opt out of a small portion of your dues. Right to work allows you to completely say, my union's not serving my interest. They're spending too much money on politics. I disagree with how they're spending that money. For instance, over 40% of union members typically vote Republican, but well over 90% of union campaign contributions go to Democrats or Democratic causes. So that's the first thing. Stop engaging in the politics. Start putting workers first, the individual first, and changing their game plan. Now, remember, as far as a legal sense, there has been no major legislative change, at least federally, to federal labor law in the United States in over half a century. And the union movement is still mired in their business plan is still an industrial effort, turn of the century, you know, 20th century to mid-1950s, us against them adversarial relationship. Unions help build this country, but their business model is old. They need to adapt. They need to change. They need to put the individual first. They need to stop doing the one-size-fits-all collective bargaining agreements, railing against merit pay, not letting good workers succeed, forcing workers to accept a contract or forcing workers to accept the representation if they don't want to. So what we need is we need a new start for the union movement. We need a new start for labor law, and we need a new start for labor's game plan as far as attracting good workers, working with management, and having all boats rise together.
Professor?
Well, I mean, there's just so many cliches in there. It's hard for me to begin to address any of them. I'm glad that Vincent agrees that this is really about politics. Yes, indeed, right to work was about gutting the political power of labor unions in the state. That's what it was primarily about. As far as their old business model, I mean, unions are adapting and changing all the time. And as I pointed out in my discussion about what happened with auto, that was not adversarial at all. You had a great deal of industry and union collaboration to turn that ship around. So the facts don't support the cliches that Vincent is uttering here.
In the last couple of minutes we have, I'd like to get the thoughts for both of you as to where you see the best opportunity for unions to be able to increase, revive, begin to grow again their membership. Would it be transplant automakers, the new domestics? Would it be the service business?
Well, the best room for union growth is where workers face the least threats. That tends to be in service industries, often lower wage work, and industries that cannot be exported. So, for example, utilities or transportation, hospitals. So in certain industries where workers don't face a threat of job loss if they try to unionize, we tend to see some growth there. But that isn't enough for a larger strategy. I mean, a larger strategy has to be combining with other progressive groups that are very concerned about the issues facing wage earners, and combining with them, forming necessary coalitions, and then dealing with this through the political process. That has to be the larger strategy.
And Vincent?
Well, I agree with the professor that they need a larger strategy. However, getting more involved in politics and the coalitions and some of the stuff that we're seeing recently is not that strategy. The strategy is changing their business model, making themselves more of a professional association, making themselves more of an insurance organization where they put the individual first, where they let the individual pick and choose if they want. I'm worried about my boss, I think he's going to retaliate against me. So I want someone to be able to represent me. Workers should have the choice of saying, okay, that's what I want from a union. I don't want to support the union's politics. Workers should also be able to say, well, I think I work hard. And I put in 125%. I see the guy next to me. He's only putting in 100%. But I really go for the gusto. I should be able to get merit pay. I should get paid more because I'm working harder. Historically, unions have been against that, and that's one of the things that they have to be able to adapt and show that they support hard-working workers that want to get ahead, that don't want the one-size-fits-all contract that we're seeing. If they do that, I see the union movement growing because they're catering towards the worker. It's putting the worker first and not the special interest.
And we'll have to leave it there for now, but I have a feeling we'll be rejoining this often in the future. We've been speaking here in the studio from the Mackinac Center for Public Policy, Vincent Fernuccio, and from the University of Michigan's Institute for Research on Labor, Employment, and the Economy, Roland Zulu. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Cindy.
Coming up next on Stateside, scientists agree the Earth's climate is changing. We'll explore the effects of climate change on the Midwest. That's next. This is Stateside on Michigan Radio. This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. One of the top issues of national debate is undoubtedly climate change. You can quickly find editorials and opinion pieces declaring that global warming is happening and human activity is the reason why. And just as easily, you can find voices that say it's not happening and the weather and climate events we're going through are part of nature's cycle. What do the scientists of America say? More than 240 scientists got together and wrote a new draft report for the federal government on how our climate is changing. It is called the National Climate Assessment. It's the third such federal climate review since 2000. With me now is one of the team of scientists who wrote the 11,000-plus page report. Professor Rosanna Bierbaum is with the School of Natural Resources and Environment at the University of Michigan. She teaches about climate policy. Currently, she's a member of the President's Council of Advisors on Science and Technology. They provide advice to the President on ways that science, technology, and innovation can lead to effective U.S. policy. And she is a lead convening author of the report's chapter on adapting to climate change. Rosanna Bierbaum joins us now in the studio.
Thank you for inviting me, Cindy. Very happy to be here.
Well, I got the sense the overarching message of this national climate assessment, it seems very clear to this layperson that the proverbial train has left the station and we're kind of past the point in being able to talk about averting climate change, and we need to now figure out how to adapt and deal with the changes that are here and more are coming. Is that a pretty fair conclusion?
Well, I think you're right that the train has left the station in that climate is changing. It's definitely happening. But where I would differ with you is to say we can't avert it. It depends what it means.
Okay.
We can certainly do quite a bit to slow the rate of change, and we need simultaneously to adapt or cope with the changes that are already underway.
The whole message has not always been able to build a consensus from the world scientists about global warming and climate changes and what's causing it. Has the science become more clear, and is there more consensus now amongst the world scientists?
Yes, I would say over the 20 years that I've studied it, the consensus has become much clearer. So if you look at the International Science Consensus Body, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, in 2007, it said global warming is unequivocal. And if you've ever heard a scientist use caveats, you know that hearing a word like unequivocal is really unexpected. And they go on to say that they are 90% certain or more than 90% certain that the changes we're seeing are due to human-induced greenhouse warming and emissions of greenhouse gases.
And I know that it's there are often efforts to politicize this and use this as some kind of a polarizing club, if you will. But here's scientists saying unequivocally, yes, it's here. And yes, human activity has caused it.
Yes. And in the same vein, as I said, the science itself has gotten sounder. I think the arguments that those who don't believe climate is changing are making are also changing. So in the past, it would be we don't see a clear human signal in the temperature record. Now there is a very clear signal in the temperature record. In fact, you cannot explain the temperature record of the last 50 years without including greenhouse gases. It's so outside the norm. The new arguments are, well, you know what? The temperature change isn't all that much, and the impacts won't be all that much. So I think there actually has been a subtle change in the arguments of those who say we should not act to control climate change. Not so much that climate isn't changing, but that it won't be so bad.
So we had this new report on how our climate's changing. How far ahead are you predicting?
Well, this assessment is mandated by the Congress. In 1990, the Global Change Act said that these shall be produced about every 4 years. They shall look at impacts of climate change on the United States, and they shall think about 25 years and 100 years out. And so we attempt to do what would be the near term, or two and a half decades out, and also the much longer term, certainly to the end of the century.
And I know that part of the report focused on the ways climate change will affect us here in the Midwest. What can we see? What does the report predict for us in the Midwest, first in the short term and then in the long term?
So, well, already the Midwest has increased 1 degree in the last 100 years. But if you look at that change, it's actually been half of that change has occurred in the last 30 years. So, again, this idea of kind of accelerating change is built into what we've seen already. And we expect that the Midwest will increase in temperatures over the next 100 years by several more degrees Fahrenheit. And, you know, people often say, well, what's a few degrees?
Yeah, what's a degree?
What's a degree? So, for example, this some of the estimates for 2100 for Michigan would have us have more than a month of temperatures over 95 degrees. So that's not something we're used to.
No.
And by the end of the century, Michigan could feel much more like the state of Arkansas. So that's very different. Similarly, already we have seen that crops and plants that used to live 120 miles south are able to live in our climate. Mm. And since we're talking on a very cold day,
yes,
the hardiness zones of plants, which means the coldest cold they can tolerate, have actually changed between 1990 and 2012, such that Michigan's coldest cold is more like minus 10 instead of like minus 20. So that might be a slight warm spot, literally and figuratively, to think about. But in those last 25 years, things like growing dogwoods in Nebraska have occurred. Mm. And so the landscape architects, who are also in the School of Natural Resources and Environment, are saying, what does it mean to plant native anymore if the zones are shifting so fast? So you asked me what it might look like by the end of the century. To keep up with this shifting climate, plants, which are not known for their mobility, would have to move on the equivalent of about 5 to 45 feet a day. And
yes.
So, you know, they are wind dispersed and all that. But it has people thinking in very different ways about what the crops and the gardens and the greenways and the forests of the future might need to look like. And there are people actually talking about, do we need to become sort of Johnny Appleseeds and plant ahead of this moving climate map? And of course, the ecosystems, which consist of plants that don't move very fast and things that fly and swim and are wind dispersed, how do you keep those relationships intact as this is moving very quickly? And so you suddenly see that climate change means most of the things that you plan for and manage, whether it be infrastructure or agriculture or fisheries or farms, will have to be thought about differently because the past is no longer prologue.
And when you think about, as you referred to, agriculture, I see from the report we can expect more and more extreme rainfall events and floods in the spring, and then that longer, drier summer. So with that increase in frequency of storms and heat waves, that spells real challenges for agriculture.
Well, it certainly does, and it also poses real problems potentially for people, of course. Mm-hmm. We'll have more heat waves. We're expecting that the climate is better for many of the allergens we're not particularly fond of, like ragweed. We're already seeing that their pollen grains are about twice the size they used to be. Ragweed season has been extended about 2 weeks in this region. We're also seeing that species that were kept in check by the cold are moving north, and that can be disease vectors as well. In the case of agriculture, Michigan may actually do better for a few years in that our growing season is about 2 weeks longer now.
All right.
So if that's true, and if there's enough water, and we don't have those extreme events you just talked about, Michigan could do well for a while. So, for example, we would expect that wheat and soy will do a little better for longer than things like corn. However, when you do get a hot day in the middle of tasseling time, you can really destroy the crop. And the increase in droughts and in floods has been seen and has recently, not in the Midwest particularly, but in various parts of the world, has been linked to the climate change we've seen already. And we've seen only too well in the Midwest this year how a drought can take out crops. And we've seen only too well how an earlier spring can backfire in the case of our cherry trees this year and the complete loss of that crop as well. So a change in extreme events may in some cases be even more important than this slowly changing average temperature.
My guest is Professor Rosina Bierbaum, who's with the University of Michigan School of Natural Resources and Environment, who has contributed to a major, major report, the National Climate Assessment, the third such federal climate review since 2000. So what are important ways that we might be able to adapt to this hotter world that is arriving both from local out to worldwide? What kinds of things maybe are working now and are being used elsewhere that we could learn from?
So that's a very interesting question. I would preface the answer by saying that the whole field of adaptation is really quite nascent compared to the field of mitigation or thinking about what you can do to control emissions of greenhouse gases. But it turns out that lots and lots of communities around the country and around the world are trying things now because they are dealing with increased extreme events. And so, for example, the city of Keene, New Hampshire, realized that it was getting more and more floods and it wasn't handling them well. So when they put in a new culvert system, they designed them to withstand both increases in population, which they knew was going to happen,
right,
but projections for increase in precipitation. And for example, now Ann Arbor, which has its stormwater pipe set to accommodate a 10-year, 24-hour flood, so the most extreme flood you would get every 10 years in 24 hours, is thinking, you know, maybe we better start put larger pipes in because we have seen extreme rainfall events and we might need to change that. A lot of cities and states are looking at what they're calling green infrastructure, or ways to sort of mimic what a natural ecosystem might be able to do. And so that would be everything from increasingly permeable pavements so that the water can drain through, mm-hmm, as opposed to run off and flash flood things, but also reconstructing wetlands, landscaping with native vegetation to the best you can figure that out.
Yes, with that moving goal line.
With that moving goal line, yes. Or individuals using things like rain barrels and cisterns. You're seeing an increase in cities in Chicago of things like green roofs. You're seeing an increase virtually everywhere in the country in light-colored roofs, which can help reduce the heat island effect of cities and can keep people cooler. You're seeing many, many cities increase the planting of green space because, again, that can reduce the heat island effect. Cities are always warmer than the countryside. In terms of health impacts, with heat stress being a very important one, obviously, being prepared and protecting people is important. And I'm really pleased that the state of Michigan, which had a Michigan Climate Action Council on which I was happy to serve, we released a report in 2009 and said, you know what, Michigan better think about an adaptation plan as well, because the impacts will be seen here and we're not ready for them. And so there is some modest activity on that front. There's the Michigan Climate and Health Adaptation Plan, which is now being implemented.
And what would that consist of?
Well, this is it basically has three goals, and the Center for Disease Control is helping the state of Michigan actually implement it. So one is to simply recognize that climate change is a public health issue, and that we better integrate climate change into our public health practice. And so in that broad goal, it's you got to educate people about the increased heat stress and climate change, train people to recognize conditions and find people that need to be removed from homes without air conditioning, have a plan. Then their second goal is that the public health agencies themselves get the tools to respond to climate impact. So the health agencies develop better surveillance and better emergency response plans. So again, so one is, the first one is more the education and connecting. Second is more getting your health agencies ready. And the third goal is really trying to figure out and target vulnerable populations. Look for the elderly, those who have respiratory problems. So very, very good first start at protecting people from one aspect of climate change. Some other states and other cities have much more comprehensive plans that cross many sectors. So there's quite a bit to learn from out there. What was very surprising to me as an academic and putting this report together for the government is that most of these stories of attempts to cope with climate change are not to be found in the published literature, or certainly not the, quote, peer-reviewed literature, because these are practitioners in cities or in states who are on the line every day, and they're making things happen, and they're trying new things. And we need, I think, to be able to bring this information into the academic domain and begin to marry theory and practice, begin to develop best practices, and to share those stories with everyone else who's trying to adapt simultaneously.
I'd like to shift, if I can, in our final minutes, to personal actions or personal responsibilities. Are there things that each of us should be doing or could do to help reduce our energy consumption and also help us adapt to the climate changes? For example, stop using the air conditioning automatically when it becomes summer?
Well, yes, I think there's no way that climate change is going to be solved either in terms of reducing emissions significantly or finding ways to adapt without people taking this seriously and thinking about how it can begin at home with them. And the focus, I think, for a U.S. citizen must very much begin with their profligate energy consumption. And just in simple terms, the average American is responsible for 20 tons of carbon dioxide, the chief greenhouse gas, a year, whereas the average in developing countries is more like one. So we're 20 times as wasteful in terms of the composite of greenhouse gases, most of which is energy related. There is a big movement in architecture and urban planning schools to begin to develop ways to revert to less air conditioning, to actually be able to open windows again, to situate houses so that they get the maximum breeze. But I think anyone can take a simple, can do a greenhouse kind of calculator on themselves, and you would be, A, surprised at how much your emissions are and where they come from. And then it's pretty easy, I would assert, for anyone to reduce their greenhouse gas footprint by 20%. And looking at your transportation, looking at your house, looking at your cooling, your heating, and a lot of that would actually end up leading to healthier people, because it would probably mean a lot more walking and biking.
It's true. Professor Rosina Bierbaum of the University of Michigan, who's with the School of Natural Resources and Environment, and she was part of this big, big report, the National Climate Assessment. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, thank you, Cindy. It was a great pleasure.
Stateside's executive producer is Zoe Clark. Stateside's engineered by Peg Watson. Our contributors are Ellie Billings, Maya Friedman, Emily Fox, Cameron Stewart, and Mercedes Mejia. This program is a production of Michigan Radio, a broadcasting service of the University of Michigan. I'm Cynthia Canty. Thank you so much for listening. Let's talk again tomorrow at 3:00.